So we're reading from Genesis chapter 7, verse 24 to chapter 9, verse 17. The waters flooded the earth for 150 days, but God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down, and on the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month, and on the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the mountains became visible. After 40 days, Noah opened a window he had made in the ark and sent out a raven, and it kept flying back and forth until the water had dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove to see if the water had receded from the surface of the ground. But the dove could find nowhere to perch because there was water over all the surface of the earth. So it returned to Noah in the ark. He reached out his hand and took the dove and brought it back to himself in the ark. He waited 7 more days and again sent out the dove from the ark. When the dove returned to him in the evening, there in its beak was a freshly plucked olive leaf. Then Noah knew that the water had receded from the earth. He waited 7 more days and sent the dove out again, but this time it did not return to him. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw that the surface of the ground was dry. By the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. Then God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives. Bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it." So Noah came out, together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, all the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground, and all the birds, everything that moves on land, came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease." Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on the beasts of the earth and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it, and for your lifeblood I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it." Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth." And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant I've established between me and all life on the earth."
Thanks, Rex. It'd be helpful to have that Bible passage in front of you. On the bottom of the sermon outline, if you haven't got it there yet, there is a little QR code you can scan to take you right to the passage. And let me pray and ask God for his help as we look at his word. Father, we thank you that your word is good. And help us this morning to see the treasures hidden in it for us and in plain sight. May we receive them with joy and faith and be encouraged at your grace and your goodness and your love. Amen. Inconceivable! Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I don't know if we can be friends anymore. It is, of course, Vizzini from The Princess Bride. There's a running gag where Vizzini, he's this kind of short, bald one with a lisp. Every time he comes across something he finds hard to believe, he exclaims, "Inconceivable!" And it gets to about the fourth time that he's declared inconceivable, and his dashing sidekick, Inigo Montoya, turns to Vizzini and says, "You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means." And it's interesting, isn't it? Often that happens. Words that people use don't quite mean what they mean. Symbols, images. And one symbol that I see often where I think, you keep using that symbol. I don't think it means what you think it means, is the rainbow. You see it everywhere, don't you? You see bumper stickers and flags and hair bows and shop windows and profile pictures. We see rainbows everywhere. I think you keep using the rainbow, but I don't think the rainbow means what you think it means. See, today, what is the rainbow? What does it mean to most people today? I think to most people today, the rainbow means I can live the way I choose. And no one has the right to judge me. See, the rainbow is like a stamp or a symbol or a sign of our freedom to self-determine, our freedom to self-express. I can live the way I choose. No one has the right to judge me. Well, I don't think it means what you think it means. And it's actually, unlike rain on your wedding day, this actually is ironic, because that is the opposite of what the rainbow really symbolizes. See, the rainbow is actually God's statement that you can't live the way you choose. That's called sin. I have the right to judge you, says God, just like I did in the flood. But, says God, I'm not going to for a little while yet. What we just read, God makes a covenant, a solemn promise that actually we're not going to wake up every day and the rains start coming again and there's another flood. Because there should be a flood every day because of our sin and our wickedness in our world. But actually what God says at the flood, in the rainbow, is that history is not going to be a continuous cycle over and over and over again of judgment days. It's not going to be a continuous cycle of floods. He's waiting. He's holding off when there will be one big day of judgment, the final judgment, when this world comes to an end. And so, as we saw last week, the flood is... First, the flood warns us of God's judgment. Second, the flood reveals God's mercy. And thirdly, the flood points to God's restoration. Well, that first point there, the flood warns us of God's judgment. We're not going to dwell much here because we looked at that last week. And so if you weren't with us last week, you missed that, or you can't remember, you can jump on our website and have a listen and go back. But basically, what we saw last week in the first half of the flood, even though the scope of it was worldwide, even though it was everyone and everything except for those people and animals in the ark, the flood only brought God's judgment to a single generation, a single slice of time in the history of the world. And every generation before and after, as we just read there in chapter 8 and verse 21, just like before the flood, after the flood, the human problem, the human condition, human wickedness is still the same. There's no change. It's not that they were really bad. No, it's the same. And we saw that because of God's holiness, because he loves people and he loves his creation so much, he cannot stand by when there's violence and evil and destruction and do nothing. And so actually, we saw last week that the flood is an act of his mercy to us in warning us. Don't get complacent. Don't think that I won't judge. Don't think that I'll sit back and do nothing forever. I will judge. And then no generation will escape. See, the flood warns of God's judgment, and it would be foolish, wouldn't it, not to listen. But point two, the flood reveals God's mercy. Have a look with me at chapter 8 and verse 1. Noah's out there floating away. It's been 150 days. He's probably thinking, God, have you forgotten me? But God hadn't forgotten. Have a look. God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and all the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now, the language here actually is a deliberate echo of Genesis 1 and 2, the first chapters of the Bible where we're told that God created the heavens and the earth. The word here that's translated wind is actually the exact same word that's translated as the Spirit back in Genesis 1 verse 2, where we're told at the beginning the earth was just a giant blob of water. And the Spirit of the Lord was over the waters. And just as then, God had caused the dry ground to emerge from beneath the water, again, the waters pull back to reveal the earth underneath. And so actually, as we get to the end of the flood, we're supposed to see it in light of the original creation as a bit of a rebirth, a refresh, a renew, a reset on the world. And we see that even more because God then renews the blessings that he gave Adam and Eve. Chapter 9 and verse 1. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, just like he had Adam and Eve. And he said to them, just like he did to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on all the birds of the sky and every creature. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, Adam and Eve, I now give you everything. This is an incredible thing, isn't it? Even though we're under curse, even though Noah is every bit as wicked as all those people that perished, even though he's every bit as guilty as all those people who died in God's judgment, God still chooses to bless. Even though God knows where it's going to go, he knows things aren't going to be any better after the flood. He still gives the same blessing he gave at the beginning when Adam and Eve were sinless. See, we deserve to be swept away in his judgment, but he hasn't forgotten or abandoned us. Because God, he's still committed to blessing humanity. He's committed to showing mercy that we don't deserve. Now, in the Bible, a long while later, there was a king called David, really famous king. He was kind of Israel's greatest king in many ways, very flawed, but he was kind of the epitome of the king that God has chosen and appointed as his anointed king. And at one point in his life, when David's under attack, one guy who was an enemy of David's called Shimei, he saw David kind of running for his life, and Shimei thought, great, here's my chance. Finally, the king's been run out of town. And he chases David along, and he's sort of kind of, you know, it's like there's a low road and a high road, and he's up the top, and David's down the bottom with all his men. And he's running along, and he's yelling out curses. He's saying, get out of here. He's throwing stones. He's pelting them with rocks. David's mates go, hey, should we go kill him for you? David says, no, no, just leave him alone. Anyway, fast forward a little bit. God brings David back to the throne. David's established. Shimei probably freaking out in his boots. David doesn't do anything. Again, his soldiers say, hey, David, what about Shimei? That guy deserves to die. David goes, yes, he does, but not today. And actually, David goes all the way till he's on his deathbed, and he speaks to his son Solomon, who's about to be king. And he says to Solomon, hey, don't forget what Shimei did. And so Solomon, God's anointed king, calls Shimei into his throne room. And he says to Shimei, hey, Shimei, you deserve to die for what you did. But I tell you what, you won't die today. I will let you live for as long as you stay in Jerusalem. If you defy this order, you leave Jerusalem, then your blood is on your own head. You will die. See, it's an example, isn't it, of showing that mercy, that grace, holding back the judgment. Now, if you know the story, you know that Shimei is not a very bright guy. One day he loses a donkey and decides, oh, okay, well, the donkey's worth more than my life, and off he goes. Solomon finds out, and Shimei surely loses his head. But actually, this is what God is doing in this covenant after the flood. Have a look at chapter 8, verse 20. Noah's come off the boat, and he builds an altar to the Lord. He takes some of the clean animals and the clean birds, and he sacrifices offerings to God. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, and he said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I've done in this flood. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. So in other words, God says, I'm not going to interrupt the normal pattern of the world that I've created. I'm not going to do another thing like this flood. The seasons will keep ticking. Day will turn to night. Night will turn to day. Until the end. History is not going to be just a constant cycle of floods. And, you know, I'm not just talking local floods, but entire world devastation. Yes, there will be disasters. Yes, there are floods, tsunamis, all those things. But never again, says God, will I wipe out the whole of the world. See, because we lived the way we chose, God does have the right to judge us. But in this covenant, this promise he makes, not just with Noah, the animals, the whole earth, all of mankind, all of animal kind, God says, I'm not going to yet. Well, why? Why is he waiting? Because he wants to restore us. Third point, the flood points to God's restoration. See, just like we saw last week, that the flood is a tiny glimpse, a tiny foretaste of the final judgment that is coming. Actually, this restoration that we see, this renewing that we see after the flood, is also a tiny foretaste, looking forward to the restoration of the whole world, of the whole of creation that will come after the final judgment. We see here in the flood, judgment, restoration, as a little mirror of the final judgment and the final restoration that God will bring. Now, in 2003, the ruler of Dubai, Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, he announced he was planning a really big project. He was going to build a new world. Anyone remember? He had this huge project called the World Islands, 300-odd islands that were kind of laid out to resemble the continents of the Earth, just off the coast of Dubai. Just a mind-boggling kind of thing to do. I remember reading the figures of how many 100 million tons, like cubic meters, and then how many 100 million tons of sand and of rock they had to pump into this place. It's just unreal. It cost $15 billion just to make those islands. And then the global financial crisis hit. So they have no power, no water. They didn't quite finish all the infrastructure. There's just nothing. They're just sort of little sand islands in the middle of nowhere. And even today, they're mostly abandoned. Now you can actually see on this slide, this was 2022, the satellite image. It's hard to even tell that's supposed to be a picture of the globe. I think this is Australia maybe, but I don't know quite what happened in their drawings. But God's project to build a new world is a million, billion, trillion times bigger. Because God's plan to fix this world is not just to refresh it, clean, but all the problems are still there. Noah brought those problems with him, human sin. The world that emerged as the waters receded still had the same curse that had affected the ground after Adam and Eve. See, God doesn't just want to kind of patch up this world, fix up this world, but in the end, he's going to make it completely, absolutely, 100% brand new. And he's going to make us completely, absolutely, 100% brand new. See, what we learn here is that God hasn't given up on his people or his creation. But actually, the only thing that's going to fix things is if he makes us completely new. I just want to point you back to the very beginning of our passage. The very first verses there, we see Noah's been in the ark 150 days. God remembers Noah. And you know from the time that the ark ran aground on the top of that mountain until when the land was completely dry and God called Noah out of the boat, it's an extra 7 months and 10 days. By the time Noah eventually gets off the boat, they've been on the boat for exactly 1 year and 10 days. Can you imagine what that'd be like? You know, finally the boat runs aground. You think, oh, great. And slowly, slowly the water's going down. 7 months, you're still in there with all those animals, all that manure, the stuffiness, the smell of the damp and rotting wood. It'd be awful. And in that time, Noah waits. And he sends out a dove. And the dove goes out, and when this dove returns with an olive leaf in its beak, it's a sign. Yes, there is life on the earth again. It's a sign we're nearly there. It's a sign that God hasn't abandoned mankind but remembered his people. It's a sign that actually life and hope and peace awaited them when they stepped out of that ark. And it's still a sign for us today, isn't it? The olive branch and the dove are symbols of peace, hope, life that God brings. And for those of us who know the story of Jesus, we see that actually that takes even more significance. Have a look at Mark chapter 1, verse 10. Jesus had gone down to be baptized, And just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. A voice came from heaven saying, "You are my Son, who I love. With you I'm well pleased." Just like the dove for Noah was a sign that God had remembered his people, a sign of life and hope and peace, we see the dove descend on Jesus, the Son of God, a sign of God had not forgotten or abandoned his people, a sign of life and hope and peace to come when we step out on the other side of the judgment into that new world. We can feel a little bit like, can't we? We're following Jesus. We probably feel a bit like I imagine Noah felt. It can feel a little bit cramped, a little bit restraining, restricting. You might feel like there are other passengers on this boat who are painful, you know, as painful as zoo animals. Sometimes we can feel like God's forgotten us, sort of floating there in the wasteland of water, waiting to finally get out into that beautiful new creation on the other side. But actually, God hasn't forgotten us. And while other people on the boat with us might be painful, so are we. We are restricted. But we're on the boat that brings us life. We are in Christ. And when we come out the other side of the judgment day with new bodies and a new creation, and everything is perfect, it'd be inconceivable, wouldn't it, to choose any other option. It'd be inconceivable not to jump on that boat, not to trust in Christ. I encourage you, hang on to him.